All right, let's get caught up really quickly. We're trying to look at the Sermon on the Mount in 8 unique sections. These sections all fit together under one basic idea of discipleship in the kingdom, but by breaking it down into these 8 sections, we can begin to effectively memorize the sermon, or at least all the main portions of it, and it helps us in study later. So lesson 1, part 1 of 8, was Matthew chapter 5, the first 12 or 13 verses. What did we call that? Be what? And what do we mean when we say, that has to be explained there, of course, what do we mean when we say Jesus opens up his sermon by saying, be blessed or happy? What does that mean in that section? In your own words. Okay, attitude. It's your attitude towards things. What else? Be attitudes. Be happy. What does that mean? Okay, we are content. That word for blessed has a lot of New Testament translations. Things like happy in places, or content, or one of my favorites is fortunate. This feeling of being fortunate no matter what's happening. And look, there were some pretty extreme cases in the Beatitudes. We forget that sometimes. It talked about being insulted and persecuted. It talked about when you had to be sorrowful over your own sin or keep your mouth shut when you want to do something else. When you're doing things that are difficult, as a disciple, we still feel extremely blessed, happy, fortunate, and content. So that's what we started with. Now that's section 1, be happy, and that's our Beatitudes. What was our second section that was quite a bit shorter? Matthew 5, 13 through 16. Be influential. It's great that you're happy. Congratulations on the sense of contentment, but now go out and make a difference with that. What we want to do is show other people what that's about and convince them to embrace the same discipleship. So what are those two very common, memorable illustrations that Jesus uses to help us understand how to be influential? One is salt, and the other is light. And that's what we studied a couple of weeks ago. You've studied that many times before, but just remember, the application of that is make a real difference in this life. And that's what we need to do. Now, as we've gotten into verses 17 through the end of the chapter, that's the lesson we're in presently. We started that last week. Now he talks about be righteous. You have a good attitude. You want to change the world by who you are. Now you need a very special, unique, almost stranger and alien kind of righteousness. And here's how he begins that, just to remind you of what we'd studied. Look at verses 17 through 20. Verse 17, do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Last week we spent quite a bit of time talking about this, but naturally all of the Jews in the room, or I should say sitting around the mountain, are thinking, what about the law? Has he just forgotten the fact that we live under law? And he addresses that here and says, no, I'm not here to destroy everything you've ever been about, but your law spoke of my coming. Then he says, verse 18, truly I say to you, unless heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until all is accomplished. That's sort of giving them some peace of mind. I'm not here to tell you to go home and tear down your Ten Commandments. I'm not here to tell you to revolt against everything you've ever learned and destroy the temple. Keep serving God through the law of Moses. Keep doing exactly what you've been doing. It will remain in effect until I have fulfilled it and brought a new law into play. But when that new law comes, it's going to be for a special kind of people. A people who has a righteousness that goes beyond what you're accustomed to seeing. Look in verse 20. I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now let me just open this up to you. How would a disciple's faithfulness exceed even the scribes and the Pharisees? Those are some pretty solid guys. How would yours surpass theirs? What were they known for?
Their appearance.
Okay. They looked the part. Is that saying we shouldn't look the part? That's not what we're saying. But they had that outside look of righteousness, but it often wasn't where? It wasn't from the heart. It wasn't in the heart. It was just for show. We're going to see this in a minute. Do you remember in Matthew chapter 6, he addresses three areas of things that you as a disciple might do. And he talks about how when the Pharisees do this stuff, they're a mess. When they do this, they do really long ones of these. What is it? Not a sermon, but prayers. Oh, they pray long and they use these terms and they repeat themselves with this rhythmic thing. What was the second thing that they did? They give to the poor, but they want everybody to know that they've given to the poor. I find it really interesting having conversations with people like that who have done wonderful things for the poor, and they find like these really unique and interesting ways to tell you what they did and how much they gave and all this and all that, because we want recognition for that. Pharisees, they did it. They did it for clout. They did it for recognition. And then what was that third thing that I cannot wait for us to talk about next week?
Fasting.
I was doing a meeting this summer and had a lady come up to me after I preached on prayer, and she said, you know, the Bible teaches just as much about Christians fasting as it does about Christians doing anything else. She was doing her finger like that. I can't wait to talk to you guys about that. But let me just advise you to go ahead and have a big meal this week, okay? But the point is this. In chapter 6, boy, they really wanted their eyes to show it. You know, they wanted to look it. They didn't try to get cleaned up. They wanted everybody to know how far they'd gone. And so what you're reading here through Matthew 5 is it has to be about more than that. I'm reminded of, I think it was Hebrews chapter 8, where it talked about how the law would not be written on stone, but the law would be written on your heart. It's who you are now. Being righteous is your identity. It's your purpose. And the outside show on that is just a natural thing that comes from the inside. So here's where we began last week, and I'll need your help for the rest of the class. There are six areas that Jesus addresses beginning in verse 21 all the way through the end of chapter 5, where he says effectively, let's talk about this thing. This is what you've heard. Maybe they'd heard the truth, maybe not. We'll talk about that each case. But this is what you've heard. This is what I'm here to tell you. And what we want to discuss in this class is, what's the difference? And how do you apply that difference? Now, we've discussed two of them already. If you'll turn the page to oaths, I filled in the answers for oaths for you just so that you can kind of see the way that this worked. And you might recall that we discussed this before. You have heard, you shall not make false vows, but you shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. That was the law. It's found in Leviticus, in Numbers, and in Deuteronomy. You make a vow, you fulfill it. Your life could be ended if you violated vows that you made to God. But I say to you, make no oath at all, but let your statement be yes or no. Anything beyond this is of evil. Now again, and there's room to disagree with me here because I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think he's saying it's unlawful to make an oath. You go and you're in court and they tell you that you won't do it because the Bible said it doesn't take an oath. I don't think that's the idea. I think what he's talking about are those Pharisees and scribes that would just verbally articulate their oaths. I swear on. And they're just throwing everybody, their mama's graves in there. Everybody's in there. And they're just, I would put up everything I own that I will do this. Jesus is, my people don't do that stuff. It's not about show or grandioso or terminologies or words. My disciples are just honest people. You take them at their word, no matter how simply or short or to the point they say it. I'm convinced that's what he's talking about here. Unless you are prepared to argue with me and say, nope, he means what he means and there's no oaths at all, be ready for here in a little while when he says to give to anybody who asks to borrow from you. Because if everything here is an absolute do this just like I say, then you have to let everybody slap you twice. You have to give everybody your coat and your shirt. You know where we're going with that, right? There's a principle at play in each one of these. And the oath principle is just say what you mean what you say, and people will trust you. Now, the second one, go back to anger. We talked about last time, this is where we ended, and then we're going to get into new information. I'll need your help. But we read verses 21 through 26. You have heard, you shall not commit murder. And that was the law. It's still the law. It's the law now. It was the law then. Pharisees would not murder, but they would treat others with contempt. I say to you, don't be angry. Don't call names. Don't label. You go make things right with people in your life. My disciples, I don't know, this sounds like such a simple concept. My disciples get along. My disciples are actually brothers and sisters. We don't see enough of that in the church, if I could just get out of comfort zone for a minute. We don't see enough of brothers and sisters getting along, working it out, making it right. To keep conflict is sin. It's non-discipleship. And you can't follow Jesus that way. If the Lord wills, on Sunday night, the sermon I want to deliver to you is Conflict Resolution 101, some basic principles for mending broken relationships. But we won't even be in this passage. So remember this. Jesus says, look, you didn't kill him. Congratulations. You're a human being. But if you want to be a Christian, you're going to leave whatever you're doing. You're going to make it right. So that's where we were last time. Now I need your help. Look at verses 27 through 30. We're going to look at four more tonight. And the first one is verses 27 through 30. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out, throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Okay, let's start with this. What had they heard? Now we're verses 27 through 30. What had they heard? Now, had they heard the truth? And had they heard it accurately? Yes, this is not a twist on words. This is not something that the Jews messed with. This is the actual law. This is one of the Ten Commandments from Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13. And in Deuteronomy, when Moses was giving the law that second and final time before they entered into the land, in Deuteronomy 5, I think verse 17, said it again. Do not commit adultery. Now, consequently, that stands under the law of Jesus. That law has been restated in, well, maybe love your neighbor. I think we cover it. But I say to you, what does Jesus add as a heart and inward element to the idea of do not commit adultery?
Not lust.
Do not lust. All right. How does he describe that here?
Don't even think about it.
All right. Now he's talking about lust, which is not necessarily physical. It's not something with your hands or with your body. It all happens in your mind. And the way he describes it in this verse is, everyone who looks, so your eyes are a part of this, looks at a woman with lust for her. So looks is the eye, and lust is the mind. This is a sin that happens with what you see and what you think, not what you touch. To touch them would be adultery in the context of what he's talking about. Everybody knows you don't do that. But I say to you, and when he says, but I say to you, what he's saying is, my disciples, the kingdom I am building is filled with people who will not even use their eyes or their minds to commit adultery in their heart. All right, any other comments on that? Do not lust.
Thinking about it in your mind is as bad as doing it.
All right. There are ways in which that statement is absolutely true, and then maybe there are ways where there's some differences. Where there are differences is, he's using the language here, you have committed adultery with her in your heart. So people say, can you divorce for lust? He's not saying they are the same sin. He's not saying that thinking about someone in a sexual way is the exact same thing as touching them with your body and joining one flesh with them. That's significant. Because later we'll talk about reasons for ending a marriage, for adultery. What would you say to someone if they said, okay, the Bible says you can divorce a mate when they commit adultery. And Jesus said in Matthew 5 and verse 28 that when you lust for her, you commit adultery. Therefore, when they lust, I can divorce them. What would your answer to that be? You better think of one. What's your answer to that? This is a common sin. Just about everyone has done this. What marriage could stand? Yes?
Well, I have been asked that before, and I don't really remember what I said, except like, it's basically like you said, that they're not the same sin. I mean, so it's specific. You know, you've got to commit adultery, which is more than just looking at
it. Yeah. I think there are a couple of angles you would take at that. One is right there in the verse. Committed adultery is what it says. But remember, this isn't about every word in its literal meaning. It's about connoting an idea. The idea here is it is just as much a sin, it is just as hurtful, it is just as wrong to do it in your heart as it is to do it with your body. And he uses in your heart, which I think is significant here, he has already committed adultery with her in his heart. The other thing I would say is when you study the word for adultery, it is unlawful sexual behavior. There's this concept of adultery being the two have become one flesh and that one flesh uniting with another flesh. There's some significance to that in Scripture. So I would not say that this verse is defending divorce for lust. But what it is doing is important. It's telling everybody in this room tonight that if we want to be Christians, if we are truly from the heart disciples of Jesus, we're fighting a battle, but it's not just with our flesh. You're going to fight that battle. You're fighting a battle with your eyes and with your mind and with what the devil wants to do with it. We have to fight all those battles equally because all those matter equally to God. That seems to be the idea. Back here first and then up. Yes, sir.
I was just going to say, if you go back to verse 26, and he says, except you, his disciples exceed those of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Pharisees and Sadducees would have said, adultery, they don't commit adultery. So therefore, they're righteous. We as Jesus' disciples have to exceed that. And that's where not even bothering to look on a woman or in lust, that we wouldn't do that.
They would probably say, but there's no law against that, would be their thing. Adultery, at least there's a law against it. So they would use sort of the law as their defense, yes.
In James chapter 1, verse 15, it says, then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. So it's of the heart. It may not be a physical sin, but when we lust after someone, if you don't stop that process, it can lead you into sin. You actually commit the act itself and lead you there.
Well, I understand your point. You're not saying that lust is not a sin. It is. I think more in James 1, coveting things, sort of looking and desiring things, there's a point where it's not a sin to do so, and there's a point where it becomes more. The thing about sexual attraction and looking and imagining is that is almost so instantaneous that look becomes a violation of God's will for your life. That seems to be emphasized here. Yes?
It's a matter of degree. You can be upset with someone, or you can be angry with someone, or you can let that anger develop into a rage. That's all degrees of, this is it is an escalation. It's the lust is one degree, and the act is another degree. So it's just it begins with the lust.
And of course, the Pharisees would say, but only that second degree is a problem. Jesus is saying, my people consider what's going on here to be just as critical as what's going on in the flesh. Here, back here, someone. Yes?
Well, it reminds me of what Paul was talking about in Colossians, the third chapter. We tell them to be heavenly minded.
Yeah.
And then he goes down to the fifth verse, and he says, here are the physical things that you need to mortify and put to death, and here are the things inside that you need to put to death. So we're talking about the uncleanness, the adultery that's happening, that's there, and then the impurities, and I can't say this one word, but evil confidence. I never have. Any of my preachers that just skip over the word.
We have evil desire.
But anyway, let's talk about put to death the outside, put to death the inside.
Yeah.
Take it all out of your life.
I would say, too, it would be a neat conversation you and I could have later, but I think all five things in Colossians 3 and 5 are all sexually based things. The idolatry, the evil desire, all of it relates to that. Okay, so real quickly before we move on, what are we supposed to do about this? This is hard. That's hard. It came from physically going into someone's home, doing something I shouldn't do, which seems a little easier to avoid. You can put a few more blocks away. To just the way I think and what I look at every day, it just got real and really hard. So what do we do to try to succeed here? Jonathan?
I found three verses that intertwine quite well together. And one of the verses can be interchanged out. But one of the verses that should not be changed out is 1 Corinthians 10:13. That talks about
28, right?
Right. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape. They may be able to endure it. And then you take John 14, 23 through 24, that says, hold on, I don't want to paraphrase it because that's not good. 14, 23 through 24, that says, Jesus answered them saying, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. So the verse that can be interchanged is whether it's 1 Corinthians 6:9, whether you're talking about a list of people who aren't entering the kingdom of heaven, or whether you're talking about 1 Corinthians 9:27 that's talking about, I discipline my body, lest after I preach I should be disqualified from the race. You can interchange the third verse with whatever situation you're struggling with, leaving us with kind of the idea that we have no excuses because God set the path for us.
All right, no excuses. All right. I'm following you. No excuses. But I need some help here. But there's something there. What is it, Josh?
2 Corinthians 10, verse 3 through 5 says, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. So the word is our weapon. It's not a our own physical ability to resist our urges without the instruction of the word is futile.
All right. Let me see. I want to keep my thoughts captive, and I don't want to think about profanity. I don't want to think about the bad words. I'm going to watch Scarface 8 straight times today. It's a really bad movie, lots of bad words. I want to see my editing tell me in minutes, too. I'm going to watch it, though. And I'm going to watch it, but I'm not going to think about it. I'm not going to think about it, and I'm going to keep my thoughts captive. What are my chances of success? Zero. What did Jesus say to do if you're having this issue? Cut it out. Throw out whatever is influencing you and overcoming your ability to control. Better to live life with one eye or one arm. And you know that's not literal. I mean, it's not going to help you. Take out one eye is not going to help you. One arm is not going to help you. But the point there is, whatever it takes, when you control your environment, you control your thoughts. You control your inputs, you control your outputs. You have to remove the things, to the best of your ability and the full extent of the law, that cause those things. And so for every person, they're having issues with lust of any kind, coveting of any kind. Find out what's around you that you're allowing to be there that's triggering that. Better to go through the rest of your life and never have that thing ever again. And to have it next to you every one of your days, and to use his language, end up in hell. There comes a point where this has to become so serious to us that we make the sacrifices and the cuts, and we count it happy, fortunate, blessed, to live right and think right for God. That's the emphasis of the language back in our text in Matthew chapter 5, and we use the language about your eye and your hand, verses 29 and 30. All right, let me get one final comment on this. If you have one, then we'll get to something else. Yes.
And he said, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are good and report, and if there be any virtue, and if there be any praise, think of these things.
Philippians chapter 4, verse 8. That's the goal. But if you're struggling with that, take a look at what's going on around you. We will always be susceptible to our environment, to what we carry with us, what we have around us. Okay, let's add another section to this. Go to verses 31 and 32. All right, so far we've talked about anger, 21 through 26, about how we treat other people. Now we're talking about how we think about others in our minds and purity, mental purity. And now to this, verse 31. It was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, keep in mind I'm reading from the New American Standard, so if your version uses different wording, you can introduce that. Except for the reason of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So question one, what had they heard? You can divorce.
But you have to write them a certificate. Where's that found? Anybody remember where that's described for us? You have a marginal note? Deuteronomy 24, that first section in Deuteronomy 24. And this had to do with their sinful behavior. This was never God approved. It was never God's idea. It was never God's plan. That's overlooked by the Pharisees. They grabbed the pieces of the law that served them well. But because of their hardness of hearts, didn't Jesus say that in Matthew 19? Because of your hardness of heart and poor behavior, God came in and said, I'm going to regulate this. I don't approve it, but I'll regulate it. And here's my rule. And here's what's interesting. The rule is actually opposite of our rules today. In Deuteronomy, you can put her away, write her a certificate, but you cannot have her again. Now it's different. Now it's you're bound to that person as long as you live. That's the only one you can have again, is the one to whom you're bound for the rest of your life. And so that's something specific to their people, and it was a regulation of their poor conduct, not God's plan from the beginning. But surely enough, that is what they had heard. But I say to you, this is a major change. So far, all he's really done is sort of deepen things. Do not murder. I'm telling you, don't even treat people poorly. Do not commit adultery. True. But I'm telling you to not even have lust. But this is a change. You have heard, send her away. But what does Jesus say to us? Everyone who divorces his wife, I'm going to take out the middle section. Everyone who divorces his wife makes her commit adultery. That's not what Deuteronomy 24 said. That's not what the law of Moses said. That's what Christ's disciples will live by. Everyone who sends her away makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. In other words, your sin is now influencing the eternal future of other people. Because of what you chose to do, she remarries. She should not have done that, but you're a party to that. You make her commit adultery, and whomever she marries commits adultery. And you've all heard sermons on this and studied this many times. The exception here that we talk about is, and it says it clearly, whoever divorces his wife, and my version says except for unchastity. Does anybody have a different wording there?
Sexual immorality.
Sexual immorality. Except for sexual immorality. The unlawful sexual conduct makes her commit adultery. Of course, Matthew 19, verse 9 ought to be added to this conversation because he uses very similar language. Look in Matthew 19. Really, the whole of the first 10 verses are vital there, because in the whole of Matthew 19, 1 through 10, they ask him in verse 3, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? Now, if you'd ask a Pharisee, what would he have said? Yes. You write her a certificate of divorce, and she goes off to marry another, and when she does that, you can never have her. She cannot divorce that man and come back to you. There are some consequences, but yes, Jesus said, have you not read verse 4? And he went all the way back to the garden and God's design, not because of the hardness of heart. This is because of God's good planning, God's design. And he says, verse 6, what God has joined together, let no man separate. So they want to know. Why did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? Now, they kind of worded that funny. He didn't say, go do this. He said, if you do this, this is how you have to do it, and these are the consequences of it. He said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted, not commanded, but permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way. And then here's the verse that's really similar to ours. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. What's the difference in the doctrinal teaching of Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19:9? What's the difference in the import, the application? It's really similar, but there's a difference.
Well, more specific.
Not only more specific, but addressing different parties. Matthew 5 is addressing who goes on to commit sin in Matthew 5. Person you put away. You put them away. They marry someone else. You now have two sinners over there. Matthew 19 is dealing with whom?
You.
You. You, by you, we mean, of course, the one who's doing the divorcing, putting away. You marry another. You are an adulterer. And so for someone to divorce without this single noted cause, which, of course, is stated again here, sexual immorality, you have committed one sin, and you have put four souls in jeopardy. So back in our text, this was an important thing for Jesus to address with the people. I say to you, this is what happens. Now, kind of goes back to the main two commandments, love God and love your neighbor. If you love your neighbor, you will not divorce your spouse. Not in the kingdom. Not under the dispensation of Christ, the government of Jesus, the kingdom. You won't do it while he's ruling on the throne, because to divorce them is not to love them. It's to put their future in jeopardy. It's to put another neighbor's future in jeopardy. It's to put whomever you eventually fall in love with, if you do so, to put their souls in jeopardy. I can't love my neighbor and divorce my spouse. And so it's really forcing them to think more about how they love the people around them. And Deuteronomy 24 kind of let them go around that for a time. Just put her away. Yes.
Matthew 5, he's teaching a great concept. Matthew 19 may be the result of this concept that he's dead. Because they're trying to trap you in Matthew 19. Okay. So then he comes back and he teaches, don't misunderstand me. Both of you can be at fault in this. You need to figure out what's happening. He also prefaces that by the love that should be in the home. Right before that in Matthew 19.
Yes.
This is what should be happening. This is what where you're missing the point. So it may have been cause and effect of why he's saying what he's saying in Matthew 19.
Maybe that's why he changed his application. In the earlier state, it was the person you divorce is now in sin. And then when they came back and asked him again, he said, all right, let me just change my language. You have to deal with this. This is sin on your part in remarriage as well. All right. Comments or questions about... what's the point? I think the point might be that God hates divorce. That's somewhere in the Bible. Although, we've got some ESV people here. Check that out. You're not going to like it. But in most versions in Malachi, it says God hates divorce. Yes?
I have a question or a statement that I want to know if you can clarify it.
Yeah.
It sounds like, okay, so if a woman commits fornication or uncleanliness sexually, she can be divorced. So when it down at the end of the verse, it says, whosoever shall marry her that is divorced commits adultery. So that means that she cannot ever remarry, just because, like, that's what I'm kind of taking away from this. It's like, because she's divorced, so it's obviously talking about marrying somebody who's divorced. So whoever marries her commits adultery. Like, even if it was a single man who married, is that what it is?
I believe that's what it's teaching. You're bound as long as you live. There is one exception to that, and that is if you put away your mate because they've been unfaithful to you, God allows you to be free from that bondage, and you can marry another. But if you're the guilty person, you're not free from the responsibility of your marriage. You're bound to what God had put together. And so here's this innocent fellow who's never married anybody before, but he's not allowed to commit fornication or adultery either. He marries her. He is in a sexual relationship with a woman who has no right to be with him. That's the sin of it. Really, the sin boils down to you're with somebody physically with which you have no right to be, and he would have no right to be. Now, this is a long study that would take many, many weeks to decide what happens if those two people decide to divorce, and what can he do next? Email Wayne. But let's not get lost. Let's not get lost in this study, because these are deep rabbit holes. We've talked about it already. Jesus' sermon is like... orange juice concentrate, like super, super concentrate. You can take that one can and you can turn it into tons and tons of gallons of orange juice. And we could do that here, but he's just sort of methodically, in very short bursts, going through, you've heard these law concepts, but I need you to think more in terms of love for people and implications of your conduct on the people around you, and that's sort of where he's going with that. All right, let's move on to something else. Verses 38 through 42. Let's talk about vengeance. Verses 38 through 42. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, is that a proper quote or an improper quote? That's a proper quote. Where did it come from? Do you have a marginal note telling you where he got that? It's in several places, actually. Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. All three say, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. All right? Let's read it together. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. All right, that's a lot of stuff right there. First of all, be careful how you answer tonight, because I'm going to ask you for something. Okay, let's start with this. Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and I think Numbers as well, say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. What was the nature of that law in the law of Moses? What was that about in the law of Moses?
It was to limit the repercussions, legal repercussions.
Okay. Okay.
In other words, you can't go more than this.
Okay. To limit, that's really well worded. Let's start with that. To limit the legal repercussions for someone. Legally, in terms of crime and punishment, this is how this will be set up. You take this, this is taken from you. All right? Someone here?
Well, that was it was a law for a physical kingdom.
Okay.
And it wasn't necessarily a spiritual law, but we have laws on the books for so many years in the penitentiary for different kinds of thefts and stuff
right.
like that.
He said a law for a physical kingdom. This helps answer why the Old Testament is this big and the New Testament is this big. You ever wonder why it's so big? And Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, the giving of the law is 123 pages, and Jesus' sermon is like 4 pages. Why is it so big? Because the law of Moses served 2 purposes, didn't it? It was the spiritual connection between Israel and God, but it was also their what law? Their secular, their civil law. It was their constitution, bill of rights, and government documents, and it was their worship and sacrifices and all the spiritual things. It served both things. So a lot of it, like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, had to do with the way their legal system would implement consequences upon those who did wrong. Today, God chose, under Christ's law, to target love God, love your neighbor, and the spiritual workings of a Christian. And then he allowed human governments, like the Roman government in their day, the American government in ours, to put rules into effect. Those rules are supposed to be based on love God, love your neighbor. They aren't always so. That handle all the law on that side. So that's part of why that was there. Now, what would someone do with it, though, if you're going to be creative with that law? All right, eye for an eye. Have you ever said this to anybody, by the way? What do you mean? When you say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, do you say in Law Book 72 and Code 8B, line 7, it said, no. What do you mean? You did it to me, I'm about to do it to you. I'm not talking about government. I'm not talking about taking you over here and seeing what a judge says or a JP. I'm talking about you did this to me, and I'm going to do it to you, and then we'll see what the courts say afterwards. There was a sense of twisting the law and overusing it. So you have heard an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and you have seen it overextended, but what is he saying to us? What's the, you don't quote what it says, but what's the idea of the list that he gives here about your cheek and your shirt? What do you think, Paul?
I have no idea. I was really hoping you would answer that question.
Go the extra mile.
Go the extra mile? All right. Go to? Be the bigger person, all right?
Find a way to diffuse the problem.
Okay. All right. We don't want to escalate the problem with personal vengeance. I think that's the idea here. Yeah.
Romans 12. Yeah.
Romans 12. Be at peace with all men and not return evil for evil. Here's what I think is going on because time's running out. We're going to pick it up next Wednesday. We need to get through this lesson. Please go ahead and dive into those 3 things, prayer, giving, and fasting. We're going to start all that next week. Here's what I think he's saying. I don't think he literally means if someone slaps you, you say, you can slap harder than that. I think what he's saying is better for someone to slap you twice than for you to slap them once. Better for someone to take your shirt and your coat than for you to get angry and act out in personal vengeance. Now, if someone takes your shirt or your coat and you go call a law officer and he comes and stops it, that's fine. Jesus isn't saying, don't call the law, give him everything you got. He's saying, don't take personal vengeance. Don't do this from some heart of anger. Use the law to protect you. But better you walk 2 miles carrying someone's stuff than to behave unbecoming even once. I think that's the idea there. If you have any comments about that, and you can remember them for 7 days, then bring them up next week. All right, thank you guys.